Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish.
I was pretty amazed at how little I knew about this issue of the exodus of the Mizrahim, the North Africans, and those from the Middle East. And my guest is the co-founder of Charif, the United Kingdom Association of Jews from the Middle East and North Africa. Lynn, thank you for talking to us here on Chai FM this afternoon.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Lynn, I'm just going to start off with kind of a bit of a smile on my face. I know we're going to talk serious issues, but let's get the funny stuff out of the way. Why on earth would you call your organization Chili Sauce?
Yeah, it's not. It's more complicated than that. It does mean spicy. It sort of recalls the whole exotic world of Mizrahi cooking. In a way.
Okay, so it's intentional.
And it also has a double meaning. I don't know if you know that, Simon. It means clever and sharp. So I thought that was rather nice. Also, it has a meaning in Arabic. It means autumn. Or does it mean winter? I can't remember now.
Either way, the ending of a summer and the beginning of something new. And that then would very much bring us to the topic at hand this afternoon, which is remembering the second Exodus on the 30th of November. Talk to me about that day, because I think those of us Ashkenazim, predominantly in South Africa, don't know much about this issue at all.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, those diasporas, which are majority Ashkenazi, and I count my own British diaspora among them, do not know a lot about what happened to the Mizrahim in the last 70 or so years. And actually, the new generation generally, whether Sephardi or Mizrahi or Ashkenazi, don't know a lot either. I just want to point out that the article I wrote in the Times of Israel was specifically about the exodus from Egypt. Yes. And actually I was focusing on a particular wave of emigration from Egypt, the one that followed the Suez Crisis in 1956. But Jews from Egypt generally talk about their exodus as the second exodus. Obviously, the first exodus was the one we mark at Passover. But the 30th of November is intended to mark the exodus of all communities from Arab countries and also Iran. So we're talking about 10 or 11 countries from Morocco in the west right through to Yemen in the east. All of them had almost a million Jews living in them. Some of the communities were extremely old. 2,000 or 3,000 years old, and certainly 1,000 years before Islam, they were established. And today, they are almost extinct. I mean, there are barely 4,000 Jews living in the Arab world today. So this, really, this day, the 30th of November, is to mark a sort of catastrophic decline, the end of a chapter in Jewish history. And it's something that isn't just relevant to Mizrahi and Sephardi people. It's relevant. It's a Jewish story, if you like.
100%. I couldn't agree with you more. I want to just dwell on that figure of a million, because that's an inordinately large number of people. I do know that there are revisionists who are attempting to rewrite history. I really do need to ask you, of that million, what percentage would you say left of own accord, and how many were forced?
Oh, I would say the overwhelming majority were forced. I would say perhaps 10% left as what I call ideological Zionists, and the rest were refugees. They were forced. It was a forced exodus.
How do you explain the fact that?
Of course, yes.
How do you explain the fact that this story has just got no traction in mainstream media at all? Because there is an equivalence between what happened with those who left what was then Palestine and those who were forced out of North Africa and the Middle East. Why is the story just not told? Are we just bad at telling our own stories?
Absolutely. I mean, there are certain reasons, there are several reasons why. But you're absolutely right that there was a sort of exchange of refugee populations within the Middle East. And in fact, more Jews left the Arab world than Palestinian Arabs left Israel. Why do we not hear about it? I'd say the main reason is that Israel did not really make an issue of it, for the best of reasons, because they didn't want to distinguish between different ethnic groups within Israel. I think they wanted everyone to integrate in the so-called melting pot back in the 50s and 60s. Also, the Jews themselves did not necessarily want to look back on what was often a painful past. You know, some of them had gone through riots, you know, they'd gone through torture or imprisonment, and some, you know, even had relatives executed. So it was not particularly a past they wanted to recall. And then there was another reason, which is that they got out alive, but the Jews, you know, who were survivors of the Shoah, you know, it was a far worse tragedy, obviously. And of course, you can't really compare what the Mizrahim went through with what Jews from Europe went through. And they felt a bit embarrassed to talk about their own tragedy.
Interesting.
And of course, another reason was, you know, that they were looking ahead to the future. It's a very Jewish thing to want to rebuild your life and not to look back. And, you know, just to get on with your life.
I hear you, and that does make sense, and that is a very Jewish thing to do, but it is interesting how very important this narrative is, given the current political developments that we are all living through currently, i.e. this fact that there is an equivalence. In another article that I read, and I'm 55 years old, and I read it for the very first time, possibly about a month ago, was that they've quantified the number of lands left in those countries by Mizrahi Jews, and I think it's something like three or four times the size of Israel. They left massive holdings there. I can't vouch for my sources. Do you know anything about that, and is that in fact correct, or am I off the mark?
Yes, I mean, it's impossible to actually quantify exactly because we have no access to records in Arab countries. But I was listening to Rabbi Eli Abadi, who was the head of Justice for Jews from Arab Countries, which is the main organization sort of representing the interests of Mizrahim in Arab countries. And he said the land lost, the Jewish-owned land lost amounted to Jordan and Lebanon combined.
Wow.
Or Jordan and Kuwait combined. So when you look at, you know, when you listen to the polemics about the West Bank and settlements and, you know, land grabbing here and there, you know, it all pales into insignificance when you consider the Jews left, lost so much in the big picture, if you like.
So I had the absolute privilege of reading a book. Gosh, I've forgotten who wrote it for this moment, but it was called In the Land of Ishmael. And it does a historical analysis of the lives of Jews under Arab rule. And we go through the Dhimmi status and we go through the jizya tax and we go, there is this absolute fake history that has been, invented about how good Jews had it under Muslim rule. That was just not the case. It depended, it seems to me, on the will of the particular ruler at the time.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct there. The Dhimmi status was a sort of second-hand, second-class status. I hesitate to use the word citizenship, you know, the second-class citizenship, because the Jews didn't have any civil rights at all. They had no legal rights. And they were dependent on the ruler of the day to protect them. And, this produced a sort of very insecure and precarious situation for Jews. They just did not know what the future would bring. But all this changed quite dramatically in the 19th century with the start of colonial rule. The Dhimmi rules were actually abolished then. And Jews acquired equal rights with the Muslims. And they entered a sort of brief golden age where they were, you know, prominent in trade and finance and the arts. And a middle class had emerged and were basically you know, running a lot of the countries, like for instance, Iraq, the civil service was mainly Jewish. And Egypt, there were entrepreneurs and modernizers, you know, who developed, all sorts of industries. They were in the stock exchange. They were in banking and, you know, they contributed a huge amount in modern times. But all that ended quite quickly, you know, with the emergence of Arab nationalism. When the war with Israel began, a lot of these countries introduced state-sanctioned laws against their Jewish citizens, and they called them the Jewish minority of Palestine, even though these Jews had absolutely nothing to do with Palestine. Some of them were even anti-Zionist or communist. You know, Jews were conflated with Zionists, and therefore they were, you know, exposed to all sorts of abuse, you know, arrest, imprisonment, even execution. And life became untenable for Jewish citizens, and therefore they felt they had to leave.
I mean, it's questionable to what extent there even was a golden window and for how long. I'm thinking as you're talking about something like the Farhud in Iraq,
yes,
how many Jews were killed, and that was way before Israel was established.
Absolutely. That was 7 years before Israel was established. You're absolutely right. The colonial powers were quite happy to exploit the Jews for, you know, because they had a very advanced level of education, but they were not always ready to protect them. And the Farhud is a case in point. The British army was actually at the gates of Baghdad and could have intervened to quell the riots, but it chose not to because
Wow.
it didn't want to be seen to be occupying the country. And therefore, at least 179 identified Jews were murdered, but the figures likely to have been a lot higher. We just will never know how many people died because, you know, bodies were thrown in the river, people were poisoned in hospital, and the mass grave was actually destroyed in the late 1950s. So we have no way of knowing exactly how many
Lynn,
died.
I hate
but it
the
was
fact.
A terrible.
Sorry,
terrible.
I have to interrupt because we are so out of time.
Yes.
I've gone way, way, way over. But just in 10 seconds.
So
no, we're going to get you back because talking to you is an absolute joy. Just in 10 seconds, talk to me about the webinar that is happening on the 30th of November and how can people join?
Yes. Well, it's actually a live event taking place at JW3, which is a community center in London. We welcome people, you know, joining us through, you know, by watching the YouTube
okay.
or the live stream, which will be on either the Harif Facebook page or the JW3 Facebook page.
Thank you so much, Lynn Julius, co-founder of Harif. It's been an absolute joy talking to you. Thank you.